I'm Norm Shealy.
NormShealy.com.
You are listening to Infinite Consciousness, your infinite access to the world
of the mind.
Hi, this is Eva Herr, and welcome to Infinite Consciousness Tonight. Thanks for taking the time out of your schedule to listen. I think you'll find tonight's show to be very interesting. I have a dear friend to me. His name is Dr. Robert Vandekassel, and we're going to talk about, among other things, his book back in 1996, the name just fled in my head, Bob. What is it? Our Dreamy Mind, sorry. And among other things, but most about dreams and his work that he's done in dreams. So welcome, Dr. Vandekassel, and thanks for taking the time to come on tonight.
I'm delighted to be here.
So before we get started, tell us a little bit about you and how you came to do what you do and where people can find your work.
Well, I'm a clinical psychologist. I'm retired. I had been at the University of Virginia Medical Center for 25 years as a full professor, and while I was there, part of my time was acting as director of the Sleep and Dream Laboratory there, and another part of my time was the director of clinical psychology training in the psychiatry department there. And along the way of life, I've developed an interest in parapsychology and had spent a year at Dr. Ryan's laboratory in Duke way back in the early 50s and got to be a president of the Parapsychological Association back in 1970. And most of the rest of my professional career has been involved with dreams because I think that's a very, very promising area. It's something we all have, and yet we're not sufficiently using it and so forth. So also along the line, I've been the president of the besides being the president of the Parapsychological Association, I've also been the president of the International Association for the Study of Dreams. I'll do that much. I mean, there's a lot more I could say, but let me see what grabs your fancy, and we'll just go for a merry-go-round right here.
Where can people find you? Do you have a website?
I do. It's, you know, the usual WWs. And then the name of the book, Our Dreaming Mind, is all one word, ourdreamingmind.com. And that would have some information about my CV and some of my publications and sort of gives a little bit more detailed description of our dreaming mind and what's in the 15 chapters that comprise it and what some of the reactions are that people who have read the book and what they had thought about the book there. And so it would be the best way to try and get a quick once over lightly about what I have been doing in dreams there. And so that would be the number one site, I think. I would give ourdreamingmind.com.
And what could we expect to find? I mean, what was your goal in writing Our Dreaming Mind? What prompted you to do that?
Well, I had been so intrigued by dreams. I had the two major influences with regard to dreams was when I had been at the University of Denver teaching there, I was supposed to have some graduate courses, and so the students, you know, were supposed to be able to have certain required ones that they had, like on theories of personality, and then there were supposed to be open-ended ones, and I was supposed to teach one of those, and I said, well, okay, what would you like to learn about? And they said, well, we'd like to learn about dreams. And I said, I don't really know much about dreams. I, you know, had gone and got my undergraduate at Syracuse University and my master's at University of Missouri and my doctorate at University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill. And the amount I know about dreams, you could probably write on a postage stamp and have space to spare. That it just was not being taught in the schools at that time. So I said, how about something else? And they said, no, we want to do dreams. And I said, okay, like, read my lips. I don't really know anything about dreams. What else would you like to learn about? We want to learn about dreams. And so they were very insistent. So I said, okay. So he kind of became like the blind leading the blind. And I said, okay, I will go and read a couple of journal articles. You read a couple of journal articles, and we'll get together at our, you know, usual time during the week and discuss it. And the more I heard them reviewing what they were reading, and the more I was finding what I was reading intriguing to share with them, I just kept getting more and more and more excited by the possibility of dreams, because one of my areas of specialization before that was in projective techniques, you know, like the Rorschach, where you look at the ink blots and try and make interpretations of them. They're nothing but ink blots, but, you know, somebody's seeing the bat, somebody's seeing a flower, somebody's seeing an airplane, somebody's seeing rotting intestines, and all kinds of different things in there. And so I realized that the more I was reading about dreams, they were like projective techniques also, so that just as with a projective technique, you could have a blank card, and then you project onto that a story of some people doing something, and this is how it's going to turn out. The dreams are very much like that. Your eyes were closed, so you weren't seeing anything externally, but you were seeing a whole lot of dramas and adventures and things and people and places when your eyes were closed. And then it seemed like there was a lot of meaning associated with that. So those were like, you know, a projective technique in action during the night. And so that was fairly familiar, you know, the concept to me. Then I had a chance to go to the Institute of Dream Research with Calvin Hall, who is one of the leading dream people, probably would have been considered the leading dream person at the time, because he had written a fantastic book back in 1953 called The Meaning of Dreams. And he had, I think, 224 dreams in there that he went through and, you know, described them briefly and what meanings he was getting out of those. And I thought, gee, that makes a lot of sense. I can see where that dream could definitely lead to that kind of conclusion. So I wanted the chance to work with him. So he offered me a job. At that time I was married and I had 5 kids, and he offered me the huge sum of $7,000 for the year to work with him. But so it was a bit of a stretch, but I thought, no, I want to learn from this man. And so I went and spent a couple years with him. And one of the things that we did while we were there was to try and work on coming up with a system to be able to score what's in a dream. So every dream has certain common denominators. It takes place in some setting. You're either out on the beach, or you're in a factory, or in a restaurant, or you're someplace, and there's different people that occur. There's single individuals, there's groups of people, there's males, there's females, there's, you know, indeterminate. You can't tell whether they're male or female. And different kinds of objects. There's cars, there's trees, there's money, and desks, and so forth. And then the people were doing things. They were either being nasty to each other and having aggressive interactions, or friendly interactions and asking somebody to go out to dinner, or sexual interactions and so forth. And they were feeling different things. They were feeling anger or confusion or happiness or sadness or whatever. And so we went through and made up rules as to how to score a dream. And so with that, we could now develop norms. So we did that with 500 dreams from female undergraduate students and 500 male undergraduate students. There were 5 dreams from each of 100 people. So we could now go through with great precision and say that men in general have these kind of dreams, women in general have these kinds of dreams, kids in general have these kind of dreams, old people have these kinds of dreams, people from culture A have these kinds of dreams, people from culture B have these other kinds of dreams. And so we could go through and now quantify the dreams and be able to, you know, with them being objectified like that, actually do statistical tests on them to say that this is highly unlikely that a certain thing would occur, because in 1,000 dreams, only one person out of 1,000 dreams had ever had this particular kind of thing in there. So it gave us a feeling of some precision. It gave us a feeling of taking the dreams from the mysterious world that we experience, you know, under the closed eyelids, to now an objective verbal report that we could quantify score, and of course this is before the days of computers, but you could now with computers go through and do a word search and determine how often any particular kind of event occurred in dreams. I can keep going on and on like this, or I can pause and give you a chance to ask questions if you like. So however you want to do it, if you don't stop me, I'll just keep going for a long, long time. So this is your last chance if you want to.
Well, I do have one question. It was kind of at the beginning of when you were talking, but I held on to it. How representative do you think our dreams are of what goes on in our lives? That's number one, or part A. I don't know how you want to answer it. Number two, or part B, however you want to look at it, is as it relates to physics, do you have any opinion on whether or not opinion regarding the existence of parallel universes, and do you think that that might answer some of the ways dreams might be experienced, maybe in our lives, in parallel universes?
Physics is not my strong suit. I've never had a class in physics at all, but I'm going to comment about some other stuff and try and tie it in to that. Now, one of the other things that happened with Calvin Hall when I was with him and we were trying to get these scoring rules so we could score up and say men usually dream of this and kids usually dream of that and so forth, was he had a grant where he wanted to try and compare how different would dreams be in a laboratory setting when you've got the electrodes attached, you can monitor the REM periods. You know if you wake them up while they're having a certain period of brainwave activity and certain kinds of muscle activities, there's a very high probability they're going to be able to report a dream. And so we were curious, what would be the difference in the dreams you have in a laboratory versus the dreams you just had in your usual bedroom, and how would they be the same or different? Now, one of the things Calvin and I had a lot of discussions about was, could there be a psychic component to dreams? And because of my background in parapsychology, I felt there could, and he was kind of sort of come see, come saw about it. He, you know, sort of said, well, it could be, but he wasn't really very convinced. So without my knowing it, one night, because we worked, I would be the person monitoring the EEG machine some nights, and I would be the sleeper some nights, and then we'd switch roles. So one night I was the dreamer with the electrodes on me, and he's monitoring my REM periods, and then waking me up to get a dream. And the dream I had had was that I was walking along, outside of a college campus, and then I felt like I should go inside this building. It was presumably some sort of college dorm or something there, or building there. And I went in, and there was a boxing match going on, and I got all involved because one guy was really getting beat up pretty bad, and I was sort of rooting for the underdog and started throwing a lot of imaginary punches, you know, like choo-choo-choo, trying to be fighting back for the guy who was getting beat up. And so when Calvin came in the room, he just had this shocked look on his face because I didn't know it, but what he had been trying to send me was a boxing scene. And so he had been throwing a lot of imaginary punches himself. And so the fact that he's doing that, he's doing his imaginary punching, I'm doing all of the punching in my dream, you know, he's trying to send a boxing match, I'm perceiving a boxing match, you know, and that one was getting pretty heavily beat up, and the other one, you know, was the one who was being much more the aggressor, startled both of us. So that was my first introduction to personally experiencing a psychic dream, and then I've had many, many, many since then. So I think if we start going from the area of accepting the reality of telepathy and psi, you know, so that we're also going to include clairvoyance and precognition, then it isn't a far step from that to getting over to physics. So I don't have the knowledge of quantum theory that I could, you know, really explicate that. But I think that once you start getting into psychic material, it certainly lends itself into some of the newer versions within physics of something can be like in two places at the same time, and all of the other kind of mysterious things that don't make common sense in terms of everyday 9-to-5 waking life, but do make sense in terms of physicists who have the ability to write out those equations and to do the experiments that show, again, intentionality is important, like with the slit screens sorts of things and so on. So I warned you, you know, I'm just going to go and go, so let me try and catch my breath and give you your next question.
I'm happy, though, when you do that. Okay. You also sent me a document. Let me get over here to it. By the way, somebody just sent me and said, wondered what you thought about having medical diagnosis in dreams.
I think it can definitely occur. I was just reading one today from Larry Burke talking about
somebody sent me that email with Larry's document and asking about that. So that's exactly the one I'm talking about.
So Larry Dossi sent a question in?
Someone sent me Larry Burke's article.
Yeah, Larry Burke, right. So he just had one in either today or yesterday about
diagnosing
cancer
and dreams.
And so I think he gives some very nice examples in his article, the one that, you know, I was reading on my computer today or yesterday, whenever it came in. And he's going to be presenting down at Virginia Beach. We're going to have a big conference on dreams in June 21 to 25, down at Virginia Beach, and Larry Burke is going to be one of the people presenting there, and I'm sure he'll be talking about cancer and dreams. Then we got a couple of other people who are going to be talking about cancer and dreams. And I myself am a cancer survivor, so there was a time when I was having a lot of trouble with my nose, and it was just big scabs were coming out, huge, big, ugly scabs, and my nose was all starting to turn purple and so on. And so we went in and did a biopsy and said that I had angiosarcoma, which is cancer of the blood cells and connective tissue. And they said, you know, this is very serious, that your life expectancy would be 15 months. And so that was not a very encouraging thing that anybody wants to hear. And then I went and I looked up one article in the European Journal of Dermatology that said there were some cases of spontaneous remission for angiosarcoma. And so I was delighted. I thought maybe I'm one of those white crows. You know, if there's even one white crow, then it means not all crows are black. There can be exceptions. And so I was so excited in talking to an oncologist up at the medical school, and he said, oh, no. There had to be a misdiagnosis because nobody recovers from angiosarcoma. I mean, the guy might as well have taken a gun and put it to my head and shot me, because I'm trying to hold on to my belief that I'm a white crow, that somehow this referee journal said people can have spontaneous remission from it. And he's, no. It had to be inaccurate reporting because nobody survives it. Well, I mean, how much encouragement is that? You know, nobody survives, and this is a, you know, big-time oncologist who supposedly has all of the best knowledge on this topic. So I was a little unhappy with what he said. And they said, and what we're going to do then is, you know, totally remove your nose, a complete rhinectomy, and then after that, we will do radiation. We're going to burn your face so that, you know, burn it badly enough that the skin is going to come off, and keep doing that every day for a month. And I said, well, you know, I'm not too thrilled about that. And they said, well, they weren't going to do the first operation. They weren't going to remove the nose unless I agreed to the other. And I said, well, okay, you know, I'll agree to having the radiation. So they took the nose off. First time they took it off, they didn't get quite enough taken off because the margins weren't quite wide enough. So they had to go back and clean off all of the margins on it. And then they made me a new nose. They took a big flap from my forehead that had an artery and a vein attached to it, took those on out through my eyebrow over where I had this big open space in my face. If you wanted to, you could have easily taken like a chicken's egg and hidden it in that space in my face where the nose had been removed. And then they took cartilage from my ears, and so used the cartilage like the building blocks for a teepee, if you want to use that analogy. So they put the cartilage from my ears in that big open space in the middle of my face, and then took the big flap of skin from my forehead and put over that with the artery and the vein, bringing in blood and taking blood away. And then I had a little, what's called a pedicle, a little hunk of skin with all of that embedded for about 3 months, and they took that off. So now I had this brand new nose. And the guy did an incredible job on it, really, really good job. So if I were sitting next to you at the bar, you'd probably never be able to really notice that it was different unless it come over here close and, look up my nose here, and you'll see it's kind of strange. So I would go in for checkups at first every 6 months and then every year, and, the guy just couldn't believe it that this was happening, because I'm supposed to be on the other side when they gave me the median expectancy of 15 months. But it had a dream, and the dream to me turned my life around. In the dream, there was a guy on a bicycle riding it along. It was sort of a little grassy hill, and he wanted to, while he's driving his bicycle up the hill, sort of move up and jump on over to the stone bridge, except he didn't make it. He didn't land up on the stone bridge. He hit against the front of it, and then it was like a big, like when you see the Roadrunner movies where he hits up against the side of the cliff and then just kind of drizzles, all the way down the face of the cliff. And it was like that, and I thought, in my dream, I'm yelling out and screaming, "Oh, my God, he's dead, he's dead, he's dead." And I was just frantic, because there was just no way he could have hit up against this huge, big stone bridge and survived. It was sort of like pulverized. Then a little bit later, I'm down in this bottom of this creek, which would have been below where the bridge had been. And then all of a sudden, I noticed there was like an opening, to a cave or something, although it seemed like there was a little membrane over it. And I sort of went through that membrane. It was like a cave there. And there in it was the person who had been on the bicycle. And now it was exactly the opposite. "My God, he's alive, he's alive. He's not dead, he's alive, he's alive. It's a miracle, it's a miracle." And I was just so, so excited by it. So for me, I took the lesson from that to be that even though at one level, objectively, it looks like when he smashed into that big stone bridge, he should have been dead, he wasn't. And so there could be, almost like miraculous transformation, and it almost seemed like it was, I say, he was like in a womb in a way. And there had also been a child with him on the basket of the bicycle. And then I looked in another little room next to it, and then there was the child, and I was like, "Oh, he's saved too. He's saved too." And so that gave me the feeling like death did not have to be inevitable. I mean, it ultimately it will be. I'm 85 now, and I know that the candle is burning down as we speak. But I'm not concerned about that. I just want to use that time till the candle goes out to try and be as productive as I can with the time. But that, for me, wasn't the diagnosis that in the dream that helped to detect the cancer, as Larry Burke is doing in his article about these kind of dreams indicate, get a checkup because of cancer is there. Mine was just dreams can indicate, even though everything looks clearly pointing that death is the only way it could go, that it doesn't have to be. that there can be a change in direction, and it could be life could suddenly be restored there. And so that dream was over 10 years ago, and so you and I are talking on the phone now, so the eminent oncologist who said, oh no, you know, there's no way it's going to be. So they weren't actually going back. They wouldn't agree to do the nose removal unless I agreed for the face burning. So they took off the nose, and then I had the epiphany. I don't want to do the other. They couldn't do anything. All it could do is what? Try and go to the wastebasket and find the old nose and take it out and put it back on. So that's my experience with dreams and cancer. So I feel that my dreaming experience basically gave me a new life relative to what was the foregone conclusion given by the cancer experts up at the medical school. I'm going to pause for breath again.
Sorry. That's amazing. It really is. So you also sent me an article about this, what you do, that's in the Journal of Scientific Exploration. And you start out talking about continuity theory. What is that?
Well, it's basically saying there's a continuity between what we dream and what our waking life is. So that the way you would ordinarily try and work with the dream and figure out how this ties in with some person's life is you read through their dreams, and if they got a whole lot of bicycles in their dreams, I'm going to assume they have a waking life interest in bicycles. And if you have a whole lot of dreams of being punished by a parent or something, I'm going to assume that in waking reality, you had an existence where a parent had done a lot of disciplining or abuse. And so that the dreams are going to be a mirror reflecting in a slightly distorted way. It's not going to be exactly the mirror there, but it's going to, if you use metaphors, because dreams really speak in metaphors. Something is like something else. And so if we go way back, Aristotle said that the best interpreter of dreams is the person who can detect similarities. So you could have, if you can see that this is somehow like something else, and get the dream and see this would be similar to that, and comment on that, very frequently that's where the dream will be at. So the continuity theory is just that. There's a continuity between waking and sleeping in which the same material in a different visual form is there. So it's not exactly the way you see it, but if you have it that way in a dream, you could see what this would mean characterologically for the person, because the metaphor is there. So the metaphor is going to speak out, and we use a lot of puns. So let's say you had something in which a lot of coins were involved, and they were smaller coins. So if you talked about coins as being change, then it means maybe you're going to have small change in your life. If you get a lot of big coins involved, then maybe it could suggest you're going to have big change in your life. So that would be an example where you're doing the play on words with the dream that way, or you now started dreaming about British coin, British money, British paper money, and that's pounds, and maybe it has something to do with a weight issue because you're dreaming about pounds that way. And if you had to say, okay, how could you abstractly talk about pounds, you know, then British paper money would be one way of concretely dreaming about money. And so it isn't like Freud said, you know, pretty much the opposite. He's saying that when you get a dream, you throw away the dream as you remembered it. That would be called the manifest content. So that if I dream of A, B, C, D, and I tell you the dream, that's the manifest content. But for Freud, it had to be at a much deeper level. And it was always almost asked backwards, that you are twisting and turning it, and you're using displacement and all kinds of other methods to keep the dream disguised, that we didn't dream directly about it. So my feelings on it would be directly opposite from the way Freud was presenting it, that we dream in this other almost perverted way to try and keep ourselves in the dark. I think we dream to get knowledge. I think we dream to get enlightenment. I think we dream to be able to see things much, much more clear, to see them more clearly under closed eyelids than we did when we had our eyes wide open. Again, I'm sorry, I keep running off on you. But
that's all right, I'm listening. But now I have a question, a personal question.
I'm sorry, did I still right. got you there?
Yep, you got me.
Okay, no,
I have a personal question now. When I was a kid and throughout my life, I've had a recurring dream, and I've always wondered what it meant. I grew up in a little town just outside of Birmingham, and we did have tornadoes all of my life in this particular area. So I don't know if it's because of that or if it has some other meaning, because I'm afraid of tornadoes. But I dreamed that I was a little girl, and I was sitting on our front porch, and this huge green spinning tornado with a face on it spun right up to my front porch, spinning as fast as it could go. And it had a face with a blank look on it, and it just sat there and looked at me and spun, but did nothing. Wasn't that?
Well,
and I've had that same
tornadoes,
exact
earthquakes, tidal waves, we can't control those. When I was just watching TV a little bit before I came in here, and there's just, you know, incredibly heavy, heavy tornadoes going throughout the middle of the country. So we can't control them. They happen to us. All we can do is we're there. You know, we can try and get into the basement or something, but the damn tornado is going to do it. It's going to do it, the damage to us, and we can't get away. It's out of our control. The same thing with tidal waves, the same thing with any other kind of natural, you know, natural disasters. And so in my experience, we usually have those when we feel our waking life is the same way. We're not really in control of it. We're not in charge of it. Somebody else has tremendous powers, and they have great powers to work that negative force on us. They can blow us out of the water. They can send us, you know, across the plains there. They can bring our house down, you know, over our heads. And so that, in my experience, when you have dreams like that where there's some sort of natural disasters, it's because you have a conception that there are some very strong, powerful forces that are stronger than you that are controlling your destiny. So sometimes, when you said you were a little girl, then certainly one of the people who have a strong control over your destiny would be your parents, so that they can whip you, they can not feed you, they can throw you out of the house, they can do all sorts of everything, and there isn't very much you can do about it, but you can just go around with that constant fear. We're right now, we're hoping we don't get a tornado in waking life. I'm so sorry it's happening to the people in the Midwest, but I'm glad it's not happening to me here. But when you get these, and there was a face on it, my guess is if you tried to really, really concentrate on that face, after a while that face would look something like somebody that you know and could recognize. That reminds me of, you know, a family member or a relative or something like that. And when they come to the house here, they make their presence known in the house, all holy hell breaks loose.
Oh.
So I don't know whether that speaks to your question.
It does. Okay, I have a few more questions. Before we finish today, so you can do this anytime you like, I sent you a PDF of the Agape book that I wrote, which was about, I guess, a dream. I don't know. I'd love your opinion on that. In the meantime, I have a couple more questions.
I had read through the Agape one, and it certainly seemed to be some situations in your family, particularly with your mother, where it would have been like she would have had the force of a tornado, that when she got angry, she would be very, very angry and very cruel and very destructive and so forth, and there wasn't a hell of a lot you could do about it.
Yeah, you're right. So, but I'm always curious, and I've got a couple of questions here, so just I'm going to tell you this, and then I'll take questions back to your paper. But I'd love to know what you think about what it was that happened. What was that thing? You know, what changed me? How did it happen? What was it? Because, I mean, that's what started me on the road of doing these radio shows and interviewing people like you, the desire to know what happened to me. What was it? Anyway, I wanted to talk about the 1966 book, Content Analysis of Dreams, and whether or not the effect of subliminal stimuli in dreams is can it affect dreams, number one. And number two, does it matter whether it's given before or during sleep? What happened in your study?
No, I'm going to go the most recent one and work backward. If we look at psi, it can happen in several different ways. If we were to talk about psi as being represented in telepathy, that's a mind-to-mind interaction. So at this dream conference coming up in Virginia Beach, the June 21 to 25, I've been for 29 years now. I started it 29 years ago here in Charlottesville, a telepathy contest there. And what we would do is randomly select several pictures, somebody selects them. They're sealed up in envelopes, and then we have somebody be a sender. So the sender has these, let's say, four pictures, no magic number, but say they got four pictures, and they're sealed up in four envelopes, four manila envelopes. The person shuffles them, takes one out, goes to the room, opens it up, and looks at it, and then tries to, quotes, send it. They look at it. They try and identify with it the colors, the emotions, the activities, you know, the size of it and everything. So they try and take on that dream and, in a sense, sort of become that dream. And then people write down their dreams. And we find that there's often some very strong correspondences. So if it's a direct mind-to-mind, we're going to call that telepathy. Now, it can be a mind-to-object thing. So if you have something in your purse with some numbers on it, and I would say, okay, the numbers on the dollar bill in your purse is, you know, 9564321 07, and that turns out to be correct, that's not telepathy because you don't have those numbers unless you're that close with your money that you memorize all of the numbers and all the dollar bills that you put in your purse, which I don't think you do. So then it's somehow my mind going directly into the object of it. So that would be clairvoyance, you know, from the French word for clear seeing. So then it's the mental ability to be able to interact with a concealed object. And then we could have precognition, where we're able to predict today what's going to happen next week. So if you did be testing all of this like with ESP cards, then if you had a card and say, okay, I'm looking at this card, you try and pick up what the card is, and you did, that would be telepathy because you're picking up on my mind. If I took the cards and shuffled them up and didn't look at it and took one off and put it on the table and said, okay, Eva, what's this card here? And you could tell me that card. You didn't get it from me because I don't know what it is. I just shuffle them up and put one on the table. So that would be clairvoyance. If, on the other hand, I said, okay, we're here today. This is Sunday night. Now, next Sunday night, I'm going to shuffle up some cards and put one on the table. What card is that going to be next week? And you could do that. Then that would be precognition because it's not in my mind right now. It wouldn't be in my mind then because I wouldn't even look at it. But you're going a week from now into looking at the target and seeing what it would be. So we've been doing that now for 29 years, and every year we get some successful results. So some of the stuff that I sent you in that latest PDF attachment, you know, describes some of those experiences that we've done that way. And I think objectively, you know, showing that somehow the mental energy in that dream is able to pick up on all kinds of information out there in the universe, that there's all kinds of interconnection That's why the title of my book is Our Dreaming Mind. There is a book by a Harvard neurophysiologist, Alan Hobson, called The Dreaming Brain. So that to me, when you say the, it sounds like a specific the brain, like one you would see in a, you know, pickled up in a bunch of hydrochloric acid or something. And the fact that it's calling it as a brain means somehow you got to see that big, you know, 5-pound gelatinous slab of meat there in the jar to be a brain. But when I say it's our dreaming mind, I want to make sure that it's a mentalistic concept. It's a mind, not a brain. And I want to make sure it isn't just the brain. I want to make sure we all acknowledge it's our dreaming mind. And so that's why the hour is, we're all equal opportunity dreamers, and we can all be dreaming together at the same time in a night. And if we could really get that going together, we need something like that with the kind of disastrous lifestyle we're collectively living around the globe right now. And unless we start, you know, getting in some ecocide, or we start trying to kill off all of this crazy rampant things with destruction of the environment and all of the other wars we seem constantly fascinated with trying to initiate, and all the misunderstanding and hatred that's going on, for me, if we could get our dreaming mind, all of our collective minds together united with dreams, then we could maybe start to make a dent on this incredible negative karma that we're building up on. Now, I'm not sure that you had some other parts of that question, and they've slipped away in the meantime. I'm not sure. What else were in your list of questions? You there, Eva?
Can you hear me? We have about 12 minutes. And before we close, I want you to make sure that we take another time to tell people again where to find you, and also tell people where they can find the information about the conference in case anybody would like to go.
Okay, if they want to get information about the conference, if they've got their handy-dandy pencils out, taking the information about my website of www.rdreamingmind.com, this one would be the www.iasdreams.org. So it's iasdreams.org. And our theme this year is Sandcastles in the Sand. And it'll be a 5-day conference. Our first day, we're going to have a Tibetan Lama open it up and speak. The next night is Kevin Tedeschi, who's the head of the Edgar Cayce Association there in Virginia Beach. And another night, we're going to have Eben Alexander, the neurophysiologist who had the remarkable near-death experience and has the book, you know, talking about his trip to heaven, and he's been on, you know, Oprah and every kind of show. So he would also be speaking. So you could get a Tibetan Lama, you could get the head of ARE, and you could get Eben Alexander talking about his remarkable experience when his brain was just floating in pus for a week's time, and his brain was technically being like brain dead, and yet he came back and is a remarkably articulate guy. He lives not too far from here. I've had him over to my house here a couple of times. And so you'd have that. We have a dream ball where people get a chance to come dressed as a character from their dream, and so we have prizes there for like the most dualistic Adam and Eve, or could be one, or it could be some kind of a group dream, or it could be, we have like a dozen different categories, and so people come out and they have a minute's time to say, you know, this is my dream, and have a costume reflecting that. So we have a lot of fun with that. So it's a very busy one. Larry Burke would be there talking about indications of cancer in dreams. We're going to have several others. It would be busy. The only negative thing about it is there's so much stuff going on, you have to choose between which of 7 different papers you would like to go to at any given time, except when we have the biggies, when we have the Lama, when we have Eben Alexander, or Kevin Tedeschi. That's the only thing going on. Everybody goes to that. Then they split up. Then you'd have to choose between maybe Dreams of Divorced Women, Dreams of Kids, Something About Nightmares. We'll have quite a few presentations on lucid dreams, and we'll have a wide, wide variety. And a lot of people are just wanting to try and share all of their exciting experiences with dreams. So they could get that at that website there. Other questions?
Did we talk about, did you tell me what you thought about where that the Agape book, was that the real response what you gave earlier?
I'm sorry, I can't quite hear. You're breaking up a little bit.
I said, when I ask you about content analysis of dreams, I also ask you about what did you think happened in the Agape book? Was that response for both of those questions, or do you still have something else to say to that?
The very tail end of that, I'm sorry, that with my 85-year year history, the hearing is going slightly, and it just your voice kind of tapered off just a little bit on there. So if you want to give me one more time, don't be afraid to shout at me. I get shouted at by women all the time.
I said, I had originally asked you about what you thought happened in the Agape book. And at the same time, I also ask about the content analysis of dreams. And you gave a response, but I didn't know if that response was to one or other of the questions or if that one
response. No, it wasn't. The response I gave you to the content analysis of dreams had nothing to do with Agape. With Agape, my experience there is I've come to know a woman who had multiple personality disorder, MPD for short, and now the more preferred term for it is DID, dissociative identity disorder. And in this case, most of them are women. 9 out of 10 are women, because it usually comes about when a person has had a horrible childhood of having been sexually or physically abused, beaten, and et cetera. So they've had terrible circumstances within their family that were so painful to them, they have to block it out at that time. Then maybe, if they're fortunate later on in life, it'll start coming back, and they can process it from an adult viewpoint. And so, as I say, 9 out of 10 DID patients are women. They usually have several personalities. You usually have a child personality. You may have a teenage personality. You may have a personality of the opposite sex. And so you can have, one book on DID had, 90 different characters in there. So there may be easily 4 or 5 different characters. This woman that I'm referring to had about a dozen personalities. One of them identified themselves as being an angel, and I had a chance to have a lot of long discussions with her when her, quote, angel personality was there, and I saw stuff going on that, having had a 40-year career in parapsychology, that these were things that just blew me away, even though I don't get blown away very quickly when it comes to paranormal activity. So the types of physical things and the amount of knowledge she knew about me and other people and things that were going to happen opened up a whole new dimension. And so you often find DID individuals having a lot of unusual psychic experiences. And so they frequently can have, psychokinetic phenomena happening around them. Their watches don't work, the telephones go off, TV blows out, and there's all kinds of physical manifestations. And they also have a great deal of knowledge about other people. They become quite psychic in ways that they wouldn't have been before, just as a lot of people who have out-of-the-body experiences now have a lot of psychic abilities. I think you had on your show PMH Atwater, few months back who had had three near-death experiences. And so comes through with a lot of psychic information now.
Yeah,
so I don't want in any way to diminish your experience saying, oh, that was just. It's not that it's, oh, that's just. I'm just saying it's similar. Everyone will be uniquely individual, but it's a kind of almost like a conversion experience where all of a sudden a whole new realm of reality and existence opens up to you that you were never aware of before. You can operate on different multidimensional levels of experiencing and knowledge. You can become quite psychic. As you put in your book, Evolve, there's a lot of synchronicities. You now start paying attention to synchronicities, and it's like, wow, where did that come from? Like, wow, what about that? Geez, how do I explain this? Wow, how do I explain that? Because you just become so sensitized to synchronicities, and they're just pop, pop, popping around you all the time, and that makes you realize that there's a lot of dimensions to existence. It isn't just the meat and potatoes kind of level of existence. There's a whole really deep, rich one of all kinds of psychic experiences, including awareness of past lives, you know, and karma. I mean, and you just get a lot of incredibly deep information imparted to you out of apparently nowhere. I mean, but when the time is right, it comes. And it's like the explanation I got was that the angel came down because God felt sorry for these unfortunate victims of all the family cruelty and so forth. And then a way to try and deal with that was to give them these other additional ways of processing that information. So that this angel that I'm talking about with this one woman, you know, had told me that with a snap of her finger, she could get her integrated and could get all these different personalities put together, but it wouldn't be effective because she hadn't learned the lessons that each one was there to teach her. So as far as the healing, that could be done with a snap of her fingers, but it wouldn't hold. There wouldn't be the glue to hold it because the glue comes from processing all of these experiences and learning what they're there and why they were there and what you were meant to learn from them. So I found an incredible amount of material in your book that it's unique. It was your life and it was very, very special, and a very sacred life that way. But it has parallels to others who also go through this massive waking up, like Rip Van Winkle in a way, coming out of a long, long, long sleeping existence to now become much more acutely aware and much more vibrating with the universe in a quite different way than you ever had been before. So that's a little longer answer, but
what about the and we've only got 5 minutes, and I want you to save some, at least a minute at the end, to go back and give your information out again. But what about the bliss thing? Remember how I told you it lasted for about 8 or 9 months? And that vibratory thing that went with it, what was that?
There's a lot of things I still don't know. I'm still processing a whole lot of stuff in my life, so I don't have all of the answers. One of the things in your book that impressed me was, you had a whole lot of chapters, and each chapter dealt with a particular kind of thing, explaining it and where you had arrived at in your effort to synthesize that. Some of mine is still ongoing. I'm trying to work on a book on angels and dreams. So after I'd had that experience with this one woman who had dissociative identity disorder and the experiences where I saw, you know, which you'd almost have to consider as miracles, because I saw some horrible physical things happen that almost literally with a snap of her finger, the quote angel was able to cure. And so I've been collecting a lot of examples of angels in dreams, and that's one of the things I'm hoping to get done before the candle burns all the way out on my existence, to get this book done on revising our dreaming mind, because it was back in 94, and there's been a lot of new information about dreams, a lot more awareness and acceptance about psychic dreams now, a lot more awareness and acceptance of lucid dreams, where you can be dreaming and aware at the same time.
So Okay.
You are aware right now I am dreaming. Right now I'm aware of talking to you on the phone, but a lucid dreamer can be, right now I'm dreaming. And so you have consciousness superimposed with your being in a state of dreaming. And so lucid dreamers are often also very, very psychic. So all this kind of elevation of consciousness to this new level of where we have all this stuff. I have some material on lucid dreams in the book. I have a whole big chapter on paranormal dreams in the book. But we've got more information on the paranormal dreams, and we got more information on lucidity. So I'd like to bring those together and then try and give my thoughts about...
Okay, we're about to have to... we're at the end of our time, Dr. Vandecastle, so I need for you to tell us... I'm sorry to interrupt you, my producer.
No problem.
And tell us one more time where to find you, please, and then we'll hope to have you again another time so we can talk for another great hour.
No, that would be wonderful. So you got the information about the website, and you got the information about the...
Tell us one more time where it is quickly, please.
Okay, the... Dream Conference is IASDREAMS.org. IASDREAMS.org. The other one from my website, one word, OurDreamingMind.com.
Thank you so much, Dr. Vandecastle.
No, thank you. I really enjoyed it and looking forward to our next time to chat.
Thank you. Good night.